WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
James Fenton has been lucky or unlucky enough to have witnessed cataclysmic events of recent history. When Saigon fell and Americans evacuated, British journalist James Fenton stayed on to find out what revolutionary justice would be like under the North Vietnamese. When the Marcoses fled the Philippines, Fenton was among the first people to enter the abandoned palace, and he has one of Imelda's monogrammed towels as a souvenir. Riots and elections recently brought Fenton to Korea. Fenton has filed for The New Statesman, The Guardian, and The Washington Post, but his specialty is lengthy first-person pieces, several of which have been published in Granta magazine. These capture both the spectacle and the day-to-day trivial details of history in the making, and describe what it's like to be in a foreign country covering somebody else's revolution. For 3 years, Fenton moved indoors to cover stage spectacles, working as the theater critic for the London Sunday Times. His reports from Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines, and Korea are collected in the new book All the Wrong Places. He's now based in the Philippines, covering the Pacific for the British paper The Independent. James Fenton was a poet when he first went to Vietnam, and he had no real credentials as a journalist.
I didn't really know what I was going to do at all when I got there. And really, I just learned as I went along, learned from other people. Foreign correspondents are supposed to be tremendously competitive, and indeed they have to be at times. But actually, when you're working in a pretty remote country, most journalists are very cooperative with each other, and you learn a lot from watching other people work.
You've written that you think the rules of objective journalism were written by old men wanting to stamp out good writing. So why did you want to go abroad and report?
Well, at the time that I went abroad, I was working for... I'd been working for an English magazine, The New Statesman. And the kind of rules that I'm talking about there, like the rule that says you mustn't use the first person in a piece of reportage, that kind of rule does not apply to English magazine journalism, and it applies much less to English newspaper journalism, indeed. It was only out there that I began to see how American newspapers work and how very, very restricted you are in terms of style when you're writing for them.
You didn't really know what you were looking for when you first went to Vietnam and Cambodia.
Not really, no. I wanted to see the place. I wanted to see what was going to happen. It was just after the American forces had been withdrawn, so it was after the Paris Peace Agreement. And one sort of knew that those regimes couldn't last forever, but we didn't really know how they would crumble or what the time scale was.
You were in Vietnam for the fall of Saigon. The American journalists were forced to evacuate. You were allowed to stay because you were credentialed by a British paper. Did you want to stay with the panic all around you? Did you want to be there?
There were a lot of other nationalities there. And it was really only in the journalistic community, it was really the Americans who were worried. And the reason why they were worried was a lot of them thought, what will happen specifically to Americans when the city falls? Now, there was a general worry about in what way will the city fall? Will it be shelled first? Will there be fighting street by street and so on? And I think we were all worried about that and thinking what would we do if we were stuck without provisions for a long time and so on and so forth. Or if there was a general turn against foreigners, if all foreigners were assumed to be Americans. But what we didn't have was this feeling that that we were Americans, and I think that unnerved quite a lot of people. There were, by the way, some Americans who stayed on, including journalists and cameramen and so on, but only a few.
As people were evacuating and you stayed on, you were almost watching people plan out how they planned to die. You saw a group of lieutenants who decided they'd just sit here and drink until they were killed. And people were all around you deciding how they'd either get evacuated or die.
Well, it's true there was a considerable panic. And some of this, I mean, there was an element of it which was also play acting, like these guys who said they would sit there and drink until they were killed. I didn't take that kind of stuff particularly seriously. What was perhaps most striking was towards the end when the looting broke out and when there was this period in which there was no, as it were, no government there, no law and order. And suddenly, at that point, people start looting. And looting is a very strange thing to me, because people do it at the most dangerous time, when you'd think that they would be much better, you know, better advised to sit cowering at home and wait for the danger to pass. No, they go out and find a shop and break it open, and then do everything to get, you know, whatever they've found home. It's a panic reaction that is not necessarily connected with, you know, with your actual poverty, that, you know, you've found something valuable and this is your big break in life. Because often the things that people found were things they would never be able to use. You know, like an air conditioner if they only had a wooden hut or something like that.
For a reporter, you said you were faced with an odd situation of either going to see what was actually happening around you or writing about it. What was the problem? You thought that the lines would go down and you wouldn't be able to give your story to your paper unless you wrote it right then and there.
You always have that problem. But if you're what we call a stringer, if you're a freelance journalist working for several different clients, then you have a choice, basically, between writing the story a lot of times, and when it's a big story, this is when you're going to make your money. So you're writing it for several different clients, or actually going out and getting the story. That's why I say, you know, there are two golden rules for stringers. One is, the more you file, the more you earn. And the second is, the more you file, the less you learn. Everybody in journalism wants to work for one good organization so that they can really have time to research a story properly and then write it in their own way. But it takes you a long time in life to reach that position.
There was another irony that you faced as a writer freelancing for American papers and being one of the few people left doing that. The Washington Post wanted you to do some writing for them after the fall of Saigon. But you said it was bad news to have an exclusive situation like that, because without a reporter there from the New York Times, it wasn't an official story, so it didn't matter that much whether the Post hired you or not. So you couldn't get a favorable price out of them.
That's right. It's true. It's true. Never get into an exclusive situation. Get an exclusive story against the competition, but never get into a place where you are the only reporter there, because that is not a commercially valuable thing.
Did you feel that the story needed to be validated by other American journalists before it was a real story?
The point was the Washington Post had asked me to stay on, and once all the other journalists had left, I then sent a cable saying, yes, but you know, I need proper payment now, and stated my terms, and was sacked immediately. And this was rather unfortunate, because there wasn't another plane out and I just missed getting out. Another funny thing happened in those days. There was one guy who left, you remember when all the helicopters evacuated? There was a British journalist who left on those helicopters and got back to England and wrote a book about the fall of Saigon. I left Saigon 3 months later. his book had already been published and was already out of print by the time I got back. I was writing a book myself, and I was quite astonished at the speed with which that had happened.
When you stayed on in South Vietnam, you really weren't sure whether you'd get arrested or not. Would you describe that real moment of indecision where you really weren't sure what your fate was going to be?
I just saw this tank going towards the gates of the palace, and I thought, great, I will take a ride on it. This is what you should do. This is the great moment. We're going to storm the palace. And first of all, they thought I was being very hostile and sort of made as if to, I mean, this is the soldiers, made as if to hit me with a rifle, and then I held out my hand and so on and so forth. Finally, I pointed to the tank and said, can I go on it? And they said, yeah. And then we rammed the palace gates and so on and went into the compound. And at that point, I realized that there were other soldiers on the tank, were prisoners, were South Vietnamese army prisoners, who were extremely unhappy about being on this tank altogether. And then I wondered, maybe I've been taken prisoner. I don't know. And I thought, well, you know, I'll find out when I get off the tank. So I sort of jumped off the tank, and turned out I wasn't. So that was okay.
Well, you were there to write stories that very few other journalists could actually get. Was there much censorship of your stories? Were you able to report what you wanted to after the North Vietnamese took over?
Oh, no. Gradually, what happened was there was a marvelous period in which nobody knew what the regulations were. And then you could travel around the countryside and talk to whomever you wanted, and anybody who was going to speak to you, you know, and was able to. Then gradually people were told not to talk to foreigners, and also you were confined to Saigon itself. And at this point, any sources that you might have had before were drying up. Either the people had left, or they no longer were in possession of any information. So it was becoming very, very difficult to work anyway. And the money had dried up and so on and so forth. And gradually, just in a natural kind of way, it was getting more or less impossible to go on. And then they also started censorship and, you know, suggesting improvements to stories. I remember the one that particularly irritated me and made me realize I wasn't going to be able to go on working there was a very small detail, but it was a factory story about a factory that was being forced to stay open. It was a factory that made net, and they had no nylon string to make the nets with, and it was being forced to stay open nevertheless. I wrote this story, and in the censorship office they said, couldn't you say it's being obliged to stay open despite the difficulties, i.e. cutting out all this stuff about there being no raw materials. And you realise that this is the form that their own journalism takes, that you never tell a simple detail. You don't say, you know, the simple fact of the matter. You dress it up in a kind of ideological guise. A friend of mine, a very distinguished cameraman who was there at the time, called Neil Davis, who is the cameraman who much more recently filmed his own death in Thailand. He was there, and happened to be doing some reporting for Reuters, and he reported a coach accident. A coach had gone off the road and everyone in it had been killed. Now, pure traffic accident story, and this story was censored. And in a society, in that particular society in Vietnam at that time, anyway, at the best of times, there were massive rumours going around. The whole place was a rumour mill. But if you have a press that doesn't report traffic accidents, then everybody when somebody just sort of disappears, we'll assume that, you know, he's been carted away for political reasons or whatever. You fuel the rumours, and you could see the Vietnamese doing this themselves, that they actually, the North Vietnamese won a lot of respect for the way that they took over Saigon initially, and then gradually they threw away all the respect that they'd won by stupid things like, I mean, they later did it with worse things, but just by stupid little things like not countenancing a press that said there's been a traffic accident.
Was it because of that you knew it was time for you to leave?
Well, I knew it was time to leave when they started censoring my copy, and still the banks hadn't opened and so on, and I just couldn't go on.
Was it hard to get out?
No, it wasn't. You got out by the United Nations, the UNHCR, the High Commission for Refugees.
Well, you were in the Philippines at the time that Corazon Aquino was elected. I want to talk to you about your experiences in the Philippines, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is journalist James Fenton, and his pieces are collected in a new book, All the Wrong Places, Adrift in the Politics of the Pacific Rim. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, James Fenton, is a poet, journalist, and former theater critic who's written for many British periodicals and was also the chief book critic and theater critic for the London Sunday Times. His new book, All the Wrong Places, includes his reporting from Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines, and Korea. He's joining us from Station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about some of your experiences in the Philippines. First of all, why did you go to the Philippines?
I went... I just got curious about what I'd read about the Philippines, and strange stories. I mean, there are all kinds of strange things happen in the Philippines recently. Last Good Friday, I saw two women being crucified on Good Friday. I didn't intend to go to the crucifixion of women. I just sort of happened to come across it. I was looking for a crucifixion, of which there are lots and lots. You know, people crucify themselves, and they do all kinds of strange things, very interesting things in the Philippines. It's a very lively, spiritual culture. A lot of religion there. It's rather like what I imagine Europe was like in the Middle Ages in that way. Tremendous processions and so on. Now, I went out to the Philippines wanting to look at just normal everyday life there and find, you know, some strange stories or whatever. But then gradually, as the Marcos regime sort of began to show signs of crumbling and this election was called, I thought, well, I have to go there then for the election. Although I didn't want to, because I didn't want to be there when there would be lots of other journalists there.
You were in the Philippines on the day that Cory Aquino was inaugurated and simultaneously Ferdinand Marcos was sworn in.
Yeah.
You spent some time at each of those ceremonies. And I think, you know, you have written as a theater critic, and I think in a way you brought a theater critic's eye to your writing. I'd like to read a paragraph from your description of the ceremony in which Ferdinand Marcos was sworn in. And you write, Imelda's dress had a slit up the back, and somewhat inelegantly from our point of view, she reached into the slit for a handkerchief. She dabbed her eyes. She blew her nose, rather too loudly. She looked again at the crowd with a look that said, My people, oh my people, you are the ones who have always supported us. You are the ones who have always understood. Marcos was gently helped from the balcony, but Imelda gave a version of not being able to bear the thought of leaving the crowd. She came back to the microphone and said words to the effect that at least there will be still some spirit among the Filipino people, and she would never forget them. That really is almost like, you know, theater.
Well, she's very theatrical. You know, people always compared her to Evita. She didn't like this. She said, well, at least I wasn't a prostitute, she said. But she was very like that kind of Evita-style legendary figure.
But I'm interested in the connection in your writing between theater criticism and political journalism. I think somehow the two must have informed each other.
Well, in theater criticism, the basic training is one of memory. You have to sit through a play, watching it, and remembering what a moment was like, and then describing it. It's a very good training.
You got into the palace at the Philippines shortly after the Marcoses fled.
Yeah.
And you have a monogrammed towel to show for it, a monogrammed Imelda Marcos towel. What did you do with the towel?
Oh, it's at home. Yeah, I used it, yeah. I mean, it's a useful little item.
It was, I'm sure, a very thrilling experience to be in the palace right after the Marcos government fell. Was it a frightening experience as well, given the crowds that were throwing in?
Well, actually, it had been frightening before, because there was a real street battle, not between government forces and the crowd, but between two elements in the crowd. One element was the remains of the Marcos rent-a-crowd people, and some of them went on being pro-Marcos, you know, for months and months after he'd gone, and some of them, I think, still expect him to come back. It was a really vicious street fight. But when that had died down, and when the crowd actually got into the palace, and the pro-Marcos people just dispersed, then it was so funny. I can't tell you how funny it was.
What was funny?
It was just people could not believe. You know, these were street urchins nobody had ever been into the palace before. I mean, as journalists, we had been. That's why I knew which way to go. But other people, a lot of people went into the wrong parts, thinking, "Oh, this is the palace." But the ones who got actually to the state rooms could not believe their eyes and could not believe that they were sitting in the chair. You know, all taking it in turns to sit in the chair where Marcos had been sitting only the day before. You know. And they were so gleeful. And then, by chance, finding the Marcos apartments just before, in the end, you know, the military took over, and, I mean, the pro-Cory forces took over to stop the whole thing being torn to pieces, which I'm sure it would have otherwise been. But just for that, for that moment, it was a tremendous fiesta, and one of the reasons that the February Revolution there was so breathtaking was that it had something of a religious element to it as well. It was the impetus it got came from the religious traditions of that country. That's why it became, I think, so powerful and unstoppable after a while.
You've seen history in the making several times. What keeps you going? What keeps you going from hotspot to hotspot? Because I know you express your fear in your pieces when you feel it, and you've felt fear many times. What keeps you going?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't go from hotspot to hotspot. I do, like, 2.5 years or 3 years in one job, and then I think of something completely contrasting. So I've been in Korea and the Philippines recently, but in between times I was, doing the theatre or doing book reviewing and living a very sedate sort of life. And the other thing is that this may sound paradoxical, but I don't really court danger. I don't like danger. I don't like doing stupid things. I get annoyed with myself if I get into a dangerous position. I want to get near enough to be able to see what is happening, to be able to experience at first hand what is happening. But there's a difference between that and getting in the middle of a fight, as it were, which I don't like to do. And which, indeed, I don't do. I've never fought anybody in my life, he said, lying.
In one of your early pieces, you developed a rule that you called crepuscular journalism, and you said that you should never believe anything you're told before dusk.
Yeah.
Explain why you came up with that rule, and if now, many years later, if you still would like to operate that way.
Oh, yeah. It's if you're trying to talk to, say, soldiers or officers in a war, if you go along in the early morning before the battle has begun, or, you know... mid-morning, and you just try to interview them, then they'll give you one version of events. But actually, they're going to give you a version that is strictly for journalists. Whereas if you meet them after dusk and spend, you know, a good amount of time with them, and gradually night draws on and so on, then the nearer it is to midnight or even the early hours of the morning, the more truthful a picture you're going to get of what they really think. That's when you'll learn. So that was why it's called crepuscular. It's the evening school of journalism. You know, the wisdom begins with the dusk.
And you still try to operate that way when you
can.
Well,
the equivalent of that, which means that you try to work with people. In an informal way, you try to spend a good amount of time with anyone that you're trying to get to know, and you see them, you know, when they're relaxed and not on their guard, and you're looking for those relaxed moments rather than when they're giving you a script that they've given to other journalists, etc.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
James Fenton's reports from the Pacific Rim have been collected in the book All the Wrong Places, which is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. He also has a collection of poems titled Children in Exile. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.